The Knowledge, brought to you in association with visitlondon.com, London's top city guide.
I'm Jonathan Glancy, I'm the architecture critic of the Guardian newspaper, and I'm here in the City of London to tell you about three of my favourite buildings in the city. These aren't great banks, they're not great exciting skyscrapers, they're three very small, modest places of worship, each a real treasure. These are buildings you could easily walk past, and people do every day in the city, but when you get inside them, they tell you a story about London, or many stories about London, that you might just miss. Stories about its culture, its ambitions, its history, its patterns of immigration, and each in interiors that are some of the finest and most unexpected you will come across anywhere in Britain. I've just walked out of Liverpool Street Station on a freezing cold winter's morning into Bishopsgate, and I'm going to walk past the taxis and the buses and the big commercial buildings and banks here to the first of my places of worship. That's St Mary Woolnoth, a church right by the Bank of England itself. There is St Mary Woolnoth, this perfect Baroque gem by Nicholas Hawksmoor. It's a church that, to me, resembles a Portland Stone Bulldog, a lovely, defiant symbol of London and London's spirituality, every bit as powerful as it was as when it opened nearly 300 years ago. But once you go inside, if you come through here, all is reason and light. I'm going to talk to Penny Champion, who's the warden of St Mary's. Penny, St Mary's is quite a survivor, isn't it? I mean, it's been threatened several times with demolition in its long life. How does it keep going?
It keeps going because it's sort of haven for city workers. It's open between 9 and 5. Quite typically, during the day, people drop in. It might be to say a prayer, but it might be just to take time out in a different sort of space.
It seems an extraordinary thing, really, to survive for so long and to still be active when all around you are the forces of money and finance and ever bigger buildings looming over this Hawksmoor Church.
Yes, but it still has meaning and levels of meaning. We have links to not only the obvious, yes, there are services here. We make it available for a group called Moot. And on Wednesday evenings, they run a session, I think, called Stressed in the City. And I think that's a wonderful purpose for using the building, because the building itself, the proportions, there's something about it. I can't describe it. The quality of the space, it's got to be better than most people's offices for a start, hasn't it? It's like taking not time out, but space out as well, which makes the space usable for the wider purpose and looking at the wider values, spiritual values, human values, apart from the narrow, focused City of London money-making.
The very fact it stands on what must be one of the most valuable sites in terms of cash in the City of London, that means in the whole world, is utterly remarkable testament to both the quality of the building itself and to the devotion of those who care for it today. Tony Tucker, you're author to the Visitor's Guide to the City of London Churches, and you're a committee member and trustee of the Friends of the City Churches. And we're standing in St Mary Woolnoth, one of what I think is one of the greatest churches in London. T.S. Eliot obviously had a great fondness for these churches, and he's one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. What did he find here? What was he listening for or looking for?
This church, St Mary Woolnoth, was significant to him because it is right opposite his office in Lombard Street, just through that wall that we're standing next to. And he sat in there and heard the bells and the clock of St Mary Woolnoth right opposite. And, of course, in the wasteland, he wrote the famous lines, "And each man fixed his eyes before his feet, flowed up the hill and down King William Street to where St Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of 9.
Does it really have a dead stroke on the sound of 9? Is that poetic licence?
I always thought it was poetic licence. I was taking a walk in here, because I'm a city guide, and somebody put their hand up to ask a question. I said, "Excuse me." I said, "Yes, what's the question?" They said, "Well, I used to work opposite, and the sound on 9 did have a dead sound at the end of it. It didn't ring like the other." So I believe, although I'm speaking secondhand here, that it was actually not poetic licence, but there was a meaning to it.
London was a city founded by foreigners, if you like, not quite immigrants, but by Romans, not by the local population. And it's been a great trading and mercantile city ever since. Some of the people who came to London in the 16th century, who came from one of the greatest mercantile and trading traditions of all, were the Sephardic Jews, who were able to create a synagogue in the city of London where no synagogue had ever been before. This is the synagogue of Bevis Marks. It's the only synagogue in the city. It's the oldest synagogue, working synagogue in Europe, with an uninterrupted tradition of Jewish worship. I'll put my skull cap on and walk inside. Gosh, this remarkable wooden interior. When you step into the synagogue, the city of London simply disappears. You can hardly hear the traffic noise. I've come here, though, to speak with Maurice Bittam, who represents the Sephardic community, the Spanish and Jewish community in London. Maurice Bittam, hello. I'm Jonathan Glancy.
Hi, nice
from
to meet you. Good morning. Hi.
Thanks
Hi.
For letting us come.
Good morning.
One of the striking features of the synagogue is the fact that it's hidden away. It still takes a little while to find it. Why is that?
When the planning permission was given to build the synagogue, one of the conditions actually was that it be hidden away, that it not be visible from the street, because Jews hadn't been here very long, they weren't accepted into society yet, and the fact that we look like a church from the outside is also deliberate, because the community wanted to be anonymous and not be too in your face.
The interior is opulent, which it really is. We're sitting in the most glorious timber structure. It's like a 17th century galleon in a way, isn't it? Truly fine oak all around us and lots of brass. And this is expensive stuff, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, at the time, the total cost for building the synagogue was £2,650. Now, I'm not sure how much that would have been today's money, but it would be a very considerable sum.
Who comes here today to pray? Who comes to the services?
Well, we're in a fairly unique situation here. Because we are in the city, many Jewish people work in this part of London, so they will come to our services midweek. And then on Friday evenings, we get the younger people coming. This is to do with the regeneration of the area, Spitalfields, Shoreditch, all these places, Hoxton, very trendy, a lot of young people moving back.
So the regeneration of London has brought new people to the synagogue, which actually is a delightful surprise, because quite often the story, certainly of the churches, is one of a steady decline in the number of people attending services, which is sad. But it's good to hear there are people of a new generation coming to use such a wonderful old building. Stephen Moorbrook is a Wren City Church, hidden away beside the Mansion House, which I'm walking past now, the Lord Mayor's home. What it's got that's so special is that it looks from the outside like, well, nothing special. But wait until we go in. As you come in, you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, lucky 13 stairs to come inside. Then, as you walk in through a little side door here in this tiny little church is one of the most magnificent domes of any church in Europe. It's a dome to certainly rival that of St. Paul's Cathedral itself by Wren, but a dome that rivals any of the great Baroque domes of Rome itself. I'm sitting now on one of the benches, one of the pews, under Wren's magnificent dome, and I'm sitting with Melvin Jeremiah, who's a church warden here. Melvin, controversially, the church was slightly modernised some years ago, I think about something like 15 years ago, I'm guessing. I'm sure I might be slightly wrong. And now under the dome it has this extraordinary modern Henry Moore altar, and you have a very, very smart white and cream marble floor. Have they been liked?
Initially, there was a lot of controversy, initially. Henry Moore was asked to produce and altered. And he decided that the best way of doing it was to make something which recalled the altar of Abraham, where he was about to sacrifice Isaac, because that is a sort of central basis for eventually the coming of Christ and the sacrifice of Christ for redemption. So you might say that it is essentially Henry Moore's idea of a suitable thing for the sacrifice of small children.
Tell me about your wonderful pulpit. It is the most extraordinary thing. Looks like a gigantic crown or magnificent hat climbing up into a great ogee arch. It looks like the hat of some great Indian sultan.
Yes, it does rather, doesn't it?
We, it's like a great cream puff
we
as
don't
well,
usually
it?
Use it, I must say.
Does it work well?
Yes, it works perfectly well.
May I try?
Yes.
Can I just have a go? Just for this?
Yes.
Thank you. I can't help it. It's when I see a pulpit, perhaps I should have been a priest, really, but my mother would have been happy. And as I come up here to speak, thank you, Sir Christopher, for creating such a fine church. It works in every conceivable way. A magnificent work of art is a great place of worship and comfort to the City of London today.
I'm back now on the city streets, having visited these three wonderful places of worship. They matter very much to me because I think they're three great London buildings and I've known them since I was a child. But they also tell powerful stories about London itself. You can find a wonderful sense of spirituality and deep comfort, but you have to scratch the surface quite hard to find them.